This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Friday, July 2nd. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker.
It's absolutely astonishing how critical race theory has pervaded every institution in the federal government. And what I've discovered is that critical race theory has become, in essence, the default ideology of the federal bureaucracy and is now being weaponized against the American people. I'd like to share three.
On September 2nd, 2020, Christopher Rufo appeared on Tucker Carlson Tonight and delivered a 3-minute monologue on the dangers of what he called critical race theory. Rufo, now a fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a conservative think tank, had come across the term while looking into the origins of the anti-racism movement. Though critical race theory was a term introduced by legal scholars in the 1970s, Rufo saw that he could turn it into a powerful bogeyman for conservatives. Rufo was right. The day after his appearance on Fox News, Mark Meadows, Donald Trump's chief of staff, called him, asking him to come to Washington to help draft an executive order condemning critical race theory. The outcry has since spread to state houses, city halls, and schools across the country. At least 22 states have introduced bills this year aimed at limiting the teaching of critical race theory, and condemnations of the theory are common at school board meetings. The uproar, largely manufactured by Rufo and amplified by conservative activists in government and by the media, goes hand in hand with the controversies around the New York Times' 1619 project and with opposition to the movement to take down Confederate monuments. Ben Wallace Wells, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the furor over critical race theory and how the new round of history wars is shaping public debates and school curricula in the U.S. Hi, Ben. Welcome back.
Hi, Dorothy. It's so nice to be here.
You spoke recently with Rufo, and
yes.
I'm guessing that many listeners have never heard of him. I will admit that included me until I learned about him from you. Why did he seize on this arcane, decades-old legal term and essentially sparking the panic we're now seeing?
Well, I wouldn't be too hard on yourself, Dorothy. I had not heard of him either until fairly recently. So to back up and to give a little bit of context, you know, Rufo's in his late 30s. He lives in outside of Seattle. He was for most of his adult life a documentary filmmaker, though most of his documentaries had been kind of apolitical travelogues. He started becoming more political and more conservative. He was radicalized in large part by the experience of homelessness, the homelessness crisis in Seattle. In the course of this, he started getting leaks, first from somebody within the government of the city of Seattle, who gave him documents, details of anti-racism seminars being conducted for employees of the city of Seattle. The seminars involved white employees of the city and black employees being separated to discuss race and racial issues separately. It included a lot of activist language about race, and Rufo was personally outraged and also thought there was a political opportunity here. He wrote an article publicizing this and became the source of subsequent leaks from people around the country in similar situations, in government, in private companies, in schools, who are also required to go through anti-racism seminars or training. Critically, Rufo didn't just sort of explain what was going on and say, you know, here's where I think it crossed the line. He also said that there is a theory that is responsible. And so he had, you know, followed the footnotes in the anti-racism trainings and followed them back through legal scholarship from the 1990s, you know, and argued that this is not just a series of, you know, isolated anti-racism seminars. They reflect a kind of indoctrination effort to push a way of thinking, critical race theory, on Americans. He told me that he thought that term, critical race theory, was the perfect villain for his case because it made the campaign seem ideological, far left, heavily academic, very divorced from the experience of ordinary people.
And let's back up just for a second, because critical race theory does have a very specific meaning in academia. Maybe start by telling us what that is, and then what Tucker Carlson, Mitch McConnell, and others mean when they use the phrase.
Yeah, they are very different. As critical race theorists have explained it to me, a kind of critical race approach sort of identifies the ways in which the structural discrimination, oppression, racism, white supremacy of the past endures in laws and in institutions. I think for Mitch McConnell, for Tucker Carlson, for the whole range of conservative actors who have reacted to this, they have seen this as an effort to denounce, American history and American institutions as inherently racist when they are not, and to ask them to take corrective action, which the conservatives think is unnecessary. I think they have also seen, as Rufo did, a kind of political opportunity that maybe here is a way to sort of turn the progressive wave that followed George Floyd's murder. They think that maybe this is a way for us to say that wave has become excessive, it has gone too far, and to inculcate a politics of backlash.
And I think you mentioned in one of your recent pieces that conservatives have been struggling in Congress, particularly ever since January 6th and the invasion of the Capitol, to come up with a way to kind of ignite indignation among their followers, and that this is one way they've found to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the conservative base became very used to a pattern of constant indignation, you know, with President Trump and constant, you know, inflammation. And the effect of the Biden presidency has sort of been to quiet all that. And so this becomes one way to reignite that kind of familiar energy and those familiar patterns of sort of racial resentment and politics of backlash.
Also, this battle closely follows the heated political debate over the 1619 Project. Maybe tell us just a little bit about that project, its conclusions, and kind of where we are now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so the 1619 Project was a sort of special issue of the New York Times Magazine that has also been developed, I think, critically here as a curricula that's being offered to public schools around the country. And it's a series of essays, some of them by journalists, some of them by historians and other academics, that seek to center the experience of the enslaved and their descendants and the institution of slavery as kind of the central fact of American history. Some of the analysis is historical, talks about the motivations of Americans through, you know, the founding of the country and the ways in which a desire to uphold or maintain slavery was central to that. Some of the analysis is current and structural. There's one essay in the original package that looks at the racial contribution and legacy in highway design around Atlanta, the way neighborhoods and towns are structured. You know, I think in general, you could say it sort of adheres relatively closely to the idea of structural racism that, you know, as the critical race theorists have argued, that embedded deeply in all kinds of policies, codes, and institutions in American life is a kind of foundationally racist beginning.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, who was the New York Times staff writer who won a Pulitzer Prize for her work on the 1619 Project, recently found herself at the center of a firestorm when her application for tenure was denied by the University of North Carolina. This week, that decision was overturned and she was granted tenure. Why was she denied it in the first place, and what led to the decision being reversed?
From the reporting, it seems that there was a critical donor to the University of North Carolina, who's a Arkansas newspaper publisher named Walter Hussman, who had read the criticisms of the 1619 Project and was worried that it was an act of advocacy rather than an act of journalism, and asked the university to reconsider her tenure appointment. There was a huge fight, you know, and Nicole Hannah-Jones was an extremely prominent, successful, and well-connected journalist, had a lot of other intellectuals and organizations sort of coming in on her side. Eventually, the board of directors at UNC approved the tenure appointment. Hussman said his gift to the university's journalism school, which was $25 million, was not contingent on that. He looked forward to meeting with Nicole Hannah-Jones, and the issue was resolved. I think you know, for a few weeks as this was live and uncertain, it really became a test of some of the very things that critical race approach sort of asks us to look at who held power within the system of the University of North Carolina and why.
So all of this is part of a reckoning over how to teach American history in both lower and higher education. Texas has always had disproportionate power over how history is taught in public schools, given its size and population. It's just had a lot of influence over which textbooks are bought and what they say.
Yeah.
Maybe tell us what's going on right now in the Texas legislature over all of this.
So as in many states, conservatives in the Texas legislature have advanced a bill saying that they want to ban critical race theory from being taught in the schools. The language in the bill mostly just limits the ways in which social studies teachers can render current events. There's a lot of language saying that they need to represent both sides fairly, that they shouldn't take one side over the other. One thing I think is important to note here is that when I talk to public school teachers in these states where there has been legislation seeking to alter teaching of history, they told me that it wouldn't really affect what they did very much at all. In many of these states, the teaching of history is pretty prescribed. There's not a ton of autonomy given to teachers, and it's certainly not the case that they are en masse going out and studying critical race theory and reinterpreting history for their students. What they told me that they're worried about is that these laws might become a way for conservative parents to go to school boards or principals and object to a relatively conventional history teaching because it doesn't give them the story that they'd like.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit newyorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
As Rufo expected, the media have broadcast this debate, and we've seen several stories about parents at elite New York private schools protesting against critical race theory. One of these protests sprung up around a letter written by Andrew Gutman, whose daughter attended the Brearley School on the Upper East Side. And he wrote to the school's administration a letter that went viral. And in it, he attacks what he calls an illiberal mindset at the school, denies the existence of systemic racism, criticizes the school's frequent use of the terms diversity, equity, and inclusiveness, and decries the Black Lives Matter movement. In this case, it seems that when Gutman says critical race theory, he's talking in large part about what he perceives as the progressive culture at his daughter's school.
I think there's a lot of that right now. This, you know, particular language around critical race theory and this idea that institutions that were once thought to be sort of morally sound are being denounced as racist, and young kids are supposedly being asked to see their own families and traditions as participating in a racist system. That is being used to make a much more general claim that there is something, you know, overwhelming happening in the teaching of racial history. And I think that, you know, it's important to be precise about what is being criticized here. Critical race theory, the term, becomes a sort of umbrella or cover for conservatives to criticize all kinds of ideas. A lot of what is happening is just that there is a more, an increased attention on and a more explicit teaching around the influence of race on history. And I think in Gutman's letter, and that's very well spotted and quoted by you, Dorothy, you really can see how some sort of you know, narrow critiques when given the kind of umbrella or cover of critical race theory can become much more maximalist.
Yeah, it's worth mentioning, though, that it isn't only conservatives who have spoken out about these issues. There are progressives at these schools in New York and elsewhere who worry and have warned about excesses in the anti-racism movement.
I mean, I think one thing that is worth noting is that this is a very new set of teachings and a very new movement. The seminars that Chris Rufo originally called attention to, that's all of a sudden an $8 billion a year industry of consultants providing anti-racism training and services. You know, I think that there are some places that still feel a little bit rough, a little bit like the anti-racism movement, maybe excessive. You know, some liberals, some progressives have wondered a little bit about, you know, the practice of segregating anti-racism seminars so that, you know, Black participants and white participants are, you know, discuss racism separately. When I asked Kimberly Crenshaw, one of the founders of critical race theory, about what she thought about these seminars, she said, a lot of them I watch and I say, you know, that's not exactly how I would do it. And so I think that that is, you know, sort of part of the kind of newness and, you know, experimental quality maybe of this field.
A number of southern states are becoming more blue, and that's just to have, we've seen that in recent elections. So in some ways, the economy and politics of the South are becoming more like those of the North, especially as so many Northerners move into the South. Can you help us see the connection between that fact and these new history wars?
I think so. You know, it's not just that the South is becoming more blue, it's that it's becoming less distinct. I think for a long time, as we taught history, we could box up a lot of the racial cruelty and oppression and simply say, you know, that belongs to the South. That's part of the South's special history. It's attached to the South's particular politics. It's a direct result of the institution of slavery. As the South has become less distinct, as its politics has become less distinct, as its culture has become less distinct, that has been a less satisfying way to treat history. I think one of the interesting things about the 1619 Project and some of the, you know, history and popular history that follows it is that it looks not at particularly Southern or specifically Southern sources for racism in our history, but at national sources, that it traces a racist history to the founding. And so, you know, I think that one interesting permutation of the history wars is that they are no longer, you know, centrally about the Confederacy, about the lost cause, about the history of segregation in the South, but they are asking questions about our shared institutions and laws and history.
And yet the lost cause mythology persists. And that's essentially the idea that the South didn't fight the Civil War primarily to preserve slavery. It's been around since Reconstruction, but it's gained traction in the battles around removing Confederate monuments. Can you explain how that all is playing out?
Sure, I can try. You know, one of the things that I spoke to David Blight, who's a historian of the Civil War and the memorialization of the Civil War at Yale. And one thing that he emphasized to me was how rapidly and successful the campaign to take down Confederate monuments has been. So as that progress has intensified, there has been an intense reaction among some people who believe that the experience of the Confederacy was central to their own family, to the South, and should not be set aside. I think that one thing that's important to keep in mind about the present day is that that seems to be diminishing. You know, in 2017, you had Republicans running statewide campaigns in Virginia, for instance, where the monuments were a central issue, or Donald Trump campaigned actively to preserve the monuments. And you just don't see very much of that anymore. Blight said to me, you know, it looks like Republicans have given up on the lost cause. And that seems to me true. So, you know, there is still this kind of intense, factional, grassroots opposition to the changing history, to monuments being taken down. But I would say it's significant that the Republican Party, its adherence to that, to the lost cause ideology, it's weakening.
But what about the argument that it's wrong to try to erase our history, and that that's what we're doing by removing these monuments, and that we would be better served by keeping them in place and providing additional context to explain why they're there and what they represent? I find that, you know, a semi-persuasive argument. What do you make of it?
I've gone back and forth on it a lot. One thing that opponents say, the people who say, no, we need to get rid of the monuments, say, is they say, these are not presentations of history. A 40-foot-high statue of Robert E. Lee riding on a horse is a heroic representation. It's not a history lesson. It's a symbol of celebration. And so they say, you know, it's very hard to put up a plaque or some context that alters that or corrects the record. I think that there is a political context here that's important. I think that in 2017, when we had the effort of the Charlottesville City Council to remove a statue of Lee in Charlottesville, become the center of this horrific white supremacist rally and violence, that it was a little easier then to hear an argument that says, these are not inert statues. These are, you know, politically active symbols. They need to go because they are becoming rallying points for white supremacy and hate. Now, I think that, you know, it may be the case that if we continue to see Republicans kind of growing just sort of disinterested in this cause, if there isn't any sort of, you know, events like Charlottesville, that then you may be able to see it, you know, as a little bit safer to consider these objects as history, to, you know, contextualize them, to put up plaques and presentations that explain them in context. I would like to think we'll get to that point.
Yet on January 6th, you know, you saw the storming of the Capitol and the Confederate flag being waved inside. There's this whiplash to the election of Joe Biden, which we're seeing play out every day, and among other ways, in these wars.
Absolutely. One of the things that the Trump election churned up that has not been settled is this conviction among many Americans that what politics today are debating is not just, you know, marginal tax rates, but the central identity of the country. And it makes sense in a way that we are having that argument not just in Washington, but in school boards and in state legislatures, that extends not just to policy, but to history too.
Thanks so much, Ben. A great pleasure.
It was great.
Ben Wallace Wells is a staff writer at The New Yorker. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app, and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.